It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Wisconsin has seen more frequent and severe flooding in recent years, and the growing impact of climate change is expected to make things worse in the future. A recent report published in the journal Climate Policy evaluated the Great Lakes states on their policies and programs for building local flood resilience. Wisconsin ranked near the middle. The state scored well in the categories of planning, guidance, and regulations and standards, while the report says Wisconsin falls behind other states in terms of providing funding and information for flood preparation. It's a complicated issue with no one-size-fits-all approaches for communities around the state with different geographies and infrastructure needs. But our next guest says there's a lot we can do to be better prepared for extreme rainfall and flooding in the future. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Have you dealt with flooding in your area? How prepared were you and your community? Do you think we need to do more to be ready for flooding? What questions do you have about our infrastructure and our flood preparedness? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. Daniel Wright is an associate professor of civil and environmental engineering at UW-Madison. He leads the Hydroclimate Extremes Research Group that studies rainfall and flooding. Daniel, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
You've noted elsewhere, Daniel, that flooding isn't just about, you know, how much rain comes down and how quickly. Can you talk about the factors literally on the ground, the infrastructure, the environment that can make a rainstorm a flood in one place and not in another?
Yeah, as you mentioned, it really does vary from place to place. And so when you're looking in areas around Wisconsin, oftentimes we need to worry about more than just rainfall. And so, for example, another really important factor is the soil itself. And so in particular, what we call the soil moisture. And so that's basically how much water is already in the soil, maybe from a rainstorm the day before or the week before, that can really impact how much runoff actually occurs when a big rainstorm hits. And so the wetter our soils are, the more severe the flood is going to be. The other thing that we have to worry about in Wisconsin and places nearby, at least in the springtime, is what happens when you have a lot of snow on the ground and then a storm comes. Because what happens in that case is that rain melts the snow that's there, and then you get runoff not only from the rain that falls, but from that melting snow as well.
Now, on the rainfall side of the equation, how much does climate change change our evaluation of risk here in the state?
Yeah, it's a really important factor, and the upper Midwest has really been one of the big hotspots for increases in extreme rainfall in the recent past. And so we all know here, just based on the difference that we feel when we go outside in wintertime versus summertime, that the warmer the air is, the more humidity it can hold. And so that is true when we look at warming temperatures due to climate change as well. And so the more water vapor, the more humidity we have in the air, the more likelihood we have of having these really big rainstorms.
I used to hear this phrase a lot more. It seems like people are moving away from it. I don't know. The 100-year flood or the 500-year flood, meaning the kind of flooding event or rainfall event you might expect once in every 100 years, once in every 500 years, whatever. What did we mean by that? And are those kind of calculations changing?
Yeah, well, the 100-year flood is not what it used to be. And so we do a lot of work trying to understand these changes. And it's made challenging by the fact that it does indeed look different in different places. And so particularly in urban areas where, first of all, you have, you know, increasing urban development. And so basically paving over natural surfaces with parking lots and buildings, that cuts down on the ability of the land to basically soak up rainfall. And so you see more runoff in urban areas as a result. It also means that that floods in urban areas really are the result of extreme rainfall, as opposed to, as I mentioned before, the other issues that can play factors, the soil moisture and the snow melt. And so What we try to do is understand in different locations, whether they be urban or rural, how these different combinations of different physical factors fit together and really translate to the likelihood of floods of different sizes, and including the 100-year flood.
Talking to Daniel Wright from UW-Madison, expert on extreme rainfall and flooding, looking at infrastructure and flood preparedness here in Wisconsin. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Has your community been hit by extreme rainfall in recent years? Did flooding result? Is your community making changes? Do you have questions for a guest about what kind of solutions might be out there? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. I imagine the answer to this might vary from place to place in the state. Daniel, but big picture, how well do you see us being prepared for flooding here in Wisconsin?
Well, one of the big problems that I see is that in many cases, we're using outdated information. And this is a problem not just in Wisconsin, it's true around the country, where in order to design infrastructure or to identify, you know, which buildings might be at risk of being in the 100-year floodplain, we're using rainfall data based on rainfall measurements that in some cases are more than 50 or more than 75 years old at this point. And when the climate is changing at the rate that it is, many scientific studies have shown that those sources of data that we're using for these types of decisions are really badly out of date and in serious need of updating.
What can a community do if they realize, hey, we did pretty good based on that standard you were just outlining? We're seeing now the risk is higher. What kind of changes can communities make to deal with the risk of more extreme rainfall, maybe higher runoff because of that development you mentioned?
Yeah, well, one example of this can be found here in Madison, where I live, where on the basis of, you know, recent experiences and some analysis done at the university as well, the city and then Dane County subsequently decided to strengthen the stormwater management ordinances. Basically, that means that property developers, if they were going to develop a new property or redevelop an older property, they would have to go to greater lengths to manage the runoff resulting from big rainfalls.
And what might that look like? I mean, I'm definitely seeing developments with that area left with some lower permeable surface, actual soil, as opposed to pavement. Is that something we're going to see more of?
Yeah, there are a variety of options available, amongst those being particularly in built-up urban areas, installing green roofs. So essentially, roofs on buildings that have vegetation and soil on top of them, which help to keep the rainfall in place once it's hit the rooftop. On the ground, using things like permeable pavements, which can actually help some of the rainfall soak into the ground. Things like rain gardens, so, you know, pieces of replacing a piece of lawn with a sort of different types of vegetation and different types of soils and gravels and things that can help increase the amount of water that soaks in. But the reality is that for really big storms like the 100-year storm or even the 500-year storm, those measures are really not sufficient. And so we need to be thinking about larger scale solutions that involve more comprehensive planning, not just at the level of individual property development, but at the scale of communities and watersheds.
We're talking to UW-Madison civil and environmental engineering professor Daniel Wright about flooding and how Wisconsin can prepare for increasing risks because of climate change. We'll get into some of those wider solutions coming up, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. How concerned are you about the risk of flooding in your area? Or am I asking too late? Have you lived through a flood in your community? Did you feel like you personally were prepared, like your community was ready to deal with that when it happened? If so, join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation with Daniel Wright, a civil and environmental engineering professor who leads the Hydroclimate Extremes Research Group at UW-Madison. He's with us today to look at how prepared Wisconsin is for heavy rainfall and flooding and the increased risk coming from climate change. Still time for you to join in at 800-642-1234. If you have questions about flood preparedness, thoughts, maybe experiences in your own life, join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Daniel, you were just talking about the need for larger scale planning, citywide, maybe countywide, and more. What kind of things do you have in mind?
Well, I think one of the important things going forward is making sure that we're working with the right information about how extreme rainfall is changing and what we should expect in the future as far as our what types of storms our infrastructure and communities might be expected to see.
And then with that information, what kind of plans can we make?
Well, I think that will help us understand how to do better infrastructure design. So, for example, do our stormwater detention basins need to be larger? The answer is probably yes, but how much larger? We're not really equipped to answer that question at this point. Similarly, stormwater pipes, how much larger do those need to be? And then, at the end of the day, I think the question is really, how expensive do those changes, how expensive are those changes really going to be? Because when you're talking about limited municipal budgets and you have to spend a larger fraction of that on infrastructure in order to deal with the impacts of climate change, that of course has impacts on everything else, including schools and libraries, et cetera.
Let's bring on a caller. Perry is with us in Okato. Perry, hi.
Yes. Is there any way to predict? I know, soil moisture and some of that plays into it, but is there any kind of guide whatsoever of so much rainfall per hour for so long? Is there anything at all that a person can say, man, this is going to be a bad one? Anything like that.
Perry, thanks a lot for the call. Daniel, as I understand, you have a software tool of sorts to help answer that kind of question.
Yeah, we do have tools available. It depends exactly on what sort of information that you're looking for. So a big focus in our work is predicting what I would call the long-term likelihood of rainfall. So not necessarily what's going to happen tomorrow or next week, but rather, what should we expect over the next year or coming years? Because those are really the kinds of questions that are important when it comes to infrastructure or community planning, where the decisions you're making about how to build things or zone things end up having multi-decadal lifetimes. Now, there's also a different aspect of this, which is short-term forecasting, and that is the question of how likely is it to is a big rainstorm over the next day or the next week? And so those are two separate problems. We have software that really focuses on the former, whereas there's the National Weather Service and other commercial organizations that do a pretty good job of forecasting the latter. Although one of the things that's becoming more challenging as the climate warms and changes is actually forecasting these types of events, even for very short lead times, like even less than one day, because the climate is not behaving the same way that it has in the past.
Perry, thanks a lot for that call. Yeah, with that pinpoint precision, Dan, just earlier this summer, my hometown in Michigan got 7 inches of rain in one night. Where my folks live, 20 minutes away, they got under 2 inches of rain. That seems like it makes it really difficult if a weather pattern breaks a certain way, one community could face a huge risk of flood, another none. Is that part of the problem here, that sort of those small differences that can make a huge difference on the ground?
Yeah, that's right. So the exact type of summertime thunderstorms that you're describing are really where a lot of the uncertainties still lie around, you know, where we're heading in terms of extreme rainfall and flooding in a warming climate. And so we understand really well scientifically the relationship between the temperature of the air and how much humidity the air can hold, and the impact that that can have on these really extreme isolated storms like you're describing. But where a lot of the uncertainty still remains is where we might expect these storms to be moving now and in the future. And so this has to do with the location of the jet stream and how warm fronts and cold fronts are changing, where the locations of those types of things are changing in a warming climate. And that part is really still a major unanswered scientific question.
And as we wrap up, Daniel, what are you watching for next from communities around the state to see if they step up and tackle some of these flooding concerns?
Well, we're now working on trying to provide some examples here at the university for communities to potentially follow, to understand some of the cost implications of adapting to this these rainfall changes, particularly focused around stormwater management infrastructure, to really help communities wrap their heads around the costs here.
Daniel, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you.
That's Daniel Wright, an associate professor of civil and environmental engineering at UW-Madison. He leads the Hydroclimate Extremes Research Group that studies rainfall and flooding. He was with us today for a look at the best ways to prepare for the risks of flooding in Wisconsin as climate change makes extreme rain events more likely. Senior care facilities across Wisconsin are facing challenges with staffing and budgeting. As Joe Schultz reports, that's led to an increase in nursing home complaints and in some cases to facilities closing their doors.
In late January, Ann Mara learned that her mother would need to find a new place to live.
It was in the middle of winter. Mom is on hospice and she's 91 years old with dementia and they're evicting her. It was just disgusting to us.
Her mom had lived in the Emerald Bay retirement community for roughly 5 years. Now, the Brown County facility was telling residents it would no longer accept Medicaid funding for residents like Mara's mother, Shirley Holtz. In a letter, the facility said it wasn't getting enough government funding to pay rising labor costs. Holtz moved out of Emerald Bay in March. Her health started to fail almost immediately.
She had lost like 15, 20 pounds in 10 days that I was gone. And she had stopped eating, stopped drinking, and she wasn't responsive when I got there. And then she passed away.
Holtz died in April, and Mara believes the move played a role. But she isn't the only Wisconsinite who's had to move a loved one from a long-term care facility in recent years. Nearly two dozen nursing homes have closed across the state since 2020. That's according to Leading Age Wisconsin, a senior living advocacy group. While long-term care facilities deal with Medicaid reimbursement that's lower than the cost of care, they also face a labor shortage that providers call a caregiver crisis. Jim Orheim is Leading Age Wisconsin's president. He says staffing shortages got worse during the COVID-19 pandemic.
We saw a lot of really seasoned staff retire, and we saw an insufficient pipeline of new talent moving into these roles. At the same time, we continue to see the aging population growing. That's going to continue to put stress on the system.
As of March 2022, 51% of nursing facilities in Wisconsin reported staffing shortages. That's according to nonprofit health policy organization KFF. There's evidence that the caregiver shortage has led to worse care for patients. Last year, the state received more complaints about nursing homes and assisted living facilities than it had since at least 2018. Matthew Bowler is a Madison attorney who takes on elder abuse and neglect cases. He says his firm has seen an increase in cases over the last year and a half.
That is a result of obviously poor care, but also it certainly does relate to understaffing.
Advocates say the recent state budget increases Medicaid reimbursement and funds initiatives aimed at addressing the caregiver crisis. They are also working with the state to develop a program that would ensure inflationary increases to reimbursement. The challenges facing long-term care facilities have been especially felt in Lincoln County, where Pinecrest Nursing Home lost over $9 million since 2014. The Lincoln County Board is now considering selling the nursing home, which it's owned since the 1950s.
That's the order. So, Renee, Todd, Elizabeth, Pastor Mike. Good?
In late June, about two dozen residents gathered at a county building to protest the possible sale. They're afraid it would mean fewer beds for lower-income residents who rely on Medicaid. For Reverend Michael Southcombe, selling the home is not the answer.
To believe that someone will buy Pinecrest, either a nonprofit or a for-profit entity, and keep the same level of service with 70 to 80% of the residents on Medicaid is magical thinking.
Yes.
The protesters turned in a petition with more than 600 signatures asking the county not to sell. Lincoln County hasn't made a final decision, but last month, the board considered authorizing a referendum that would have granted Pinecrest an extra $3 million per year. The county board voted down that proposal 9-13. Joe Schultz, Wisconsin Public Radio.
You can read that story and see a lot more from the Wisconsin Public Radio news team at WPR.org. While you're there, you can listen live to this network and check out our extensive archives as well. I'm Rob Ferret. Stick around. There's a lot more to come. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Republicans in the Wisconsin State Legislature have said that they're considering impeachment proceedings against State Supreme Court Justice Janet Protasiewicz if she does not recuse herself from upcoming lawsuits seeking to redraw the state's voting maps. The Republican lawmakers claim that statements that Justice Protasiewicz made on the campaign trail about gerrymandering in the state and campaign donations she received from the state's Democratic Party should disqualify her from sitting on these redistricting cases. This has all caught the attention of national and even international news outlets. It's not clear at this point, though, if Republican lawmakers would actually follow through on suggestions that they might pursue impeachment. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Should the state's newest justice recuse herself from redistricting cases? Should the state legislature impeach her if she does not? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. Rich Kramer is a reporter here at Wisconsin Public Radio. He's been following this story. Rich, welcome back to the show.
Hey, Rob. Thanks for having me.
All right. Before we get to the I word, impeachment, Rich, let's talk about these redistricting cases and the comments that then-candidate Protasiewicz made about the state's current legislative maps. That's kind of what got us here.
Yeah. During the campaign, Justice Protasiewicz wasn't bashful about talking about redistricting. She also talked about the state's abortion ban or near total ban, I should say. So she said with regard to the voting maps that the maps were rigged, the GOP drawn maps, and that she would look forward to taking a look at them if a case came to the state Supreme Court.
Now, Assembly Speaker Robin Voss, last month in an interview, had broached this idea of impeachment. In a more recent interview, he didn't reject it out of hand. He seems to be a little milder on it. Can you give the history of talk of impeachment here, Rich?
Yeah, so Assembly Speaker Voss was on a conservative radio show out of Wausau last month in August, and essentially said that those comments from Protasiewicz showed that she has bias in the case and that she couldn't impartially, you know, decide them. So it all started saying, you know, he hopes that she recuses, but did say that essentially said that impeachment would be on the table if she failed to recuse, because that would be a conflict that that he just couldn't abide. So that's where things were last month. It got a lot of attention, as you mentioned, a lot of attention. You've got the Democratic Party of Wisconsin pouring money into an ad campaign trying to convince lawmakers to back away from that. And more recently, Voss does appear to have softened, or at least that's what's been the way it's been reported. Last week, he was on a conservative radio show hosted by Dan O'Donnell, and he said that he's not predicting impeachment because he doesn't know if the assembly will do that. He did repeat calls for her, for Justice Protasiewicz to recuse. He said essentially that that would be a good thing for her legacy, because people have heard the comments, and Voss says they can see that she couldn't be impartial in this situation.
Take us through briefly, Rich, the impeachment process.
Yeah, there's a couple of different ways to remove a judge or justice from their seat, whether it be on the Supreme Court or a circuit court or state of appeal, court of appeals. So the first is impeachment. That's what everyone's been talking about. The assembly, the state assembly, would initiate that with a simple majority. But that has to be for specific reasons, including, according to the statute, corrupt conduct in office or for the commission of a crime or misdemeanor. If the assembly votes to impeach Justice Protasiewicz in this case, then it would be up to the state Senate to act as a court, and they could convict or acquit Protasiewicz. The conviction would require a two-thirds vote. But in the meantime, if the assembly votes to impeach, the time between that and Senate action, Protasiewicz would not be allowed to sit on cases. She'd essentially be sidelined. There's also a process called removal by address, and that requires a two-thirds majority in the state assembly and the state Senate. And in that situation, the legislature must serve the individual judge or justice with a copy of charges. The judge or justice would have the ability to present a defense, and those charges must allege misconduct or that a judge isn't physically or mentally qualified to exercise their judicial functions. So there's a little bit, it's more vague, I guess, that, but those are the two processes that I'm aware of at this point. It's moving so quickly.
And if I read your reporting correctly, Rich, you counted up the number of judicial impeachments in all of Wisconsin history, and the number you came up with was one.
Yeah,
one time the assembly advanced this, the Senate didn't end up convicting in this particular case. So this is not something we're doing all the time here.
Not since 1853. Levi Hubbell was on the state Supreme Court. This is a time when briefly there was two Supreme Courts. And anyway, he went back to being a circuit court judge, but he was impeached over claims that he accepted bribes and heard cases in which he had financial interests. As you mentioned, he was acquitted, but ended up resigning as a circuit court judge. So this is largely, I mean, unprecedented territory.
Talking to Rich Kramer, WPR reporter, about at least talk of an impeachment process against Wisconsin's newest state Supreme Court Justice, Jana Protasiewicz, if she doesn't recuse from a case on redistricting. Let's bring in a caller at 800-642-1234. Mark is with us in Rockton. Mark, hi.
Hi, enjoy your show. Look, I might be the only true independent left in the state. So the question isn't whether the maps are rigged. The maps are rigged. In so many states, including Wisconsin, you've got two-thirds of one party holding the legislature control. And then in our case, we've got Democrats winning the majority of the vote for governor or the recent Supreme Court. That, by definition, means that maps are rigged. So they might not like that term, but the maps are rigged. The question is, are the maps legal? And that question is for the Supreme Court to decide. I don't, to my knowledge, think that she rendered an opinion on whether the current maps are illegal, but they're rigged.
Mark, thanks a lot for the call. And Rich, that might be a point that people will be arguing about. She expressed a personal view on the current maps, but Mark makes the case She didn't say how she would rule on them. She didn't say if they were legal or illegal. Is that the kind of argument we might be seeing if this thing moves forward?
Absolutely, 100%. So Protasiewicz has previously said that she wasn't, you know, her comments weren't committing her to, like, how she's going to vote on it, just expressing values. And that values about the general idea and whether or not the maps are rigged. So that falls into all sorts of tricky areas. In 2002, the U.S. Supreme Court ruled that candidates running for justice positions can express their values, and it's free speech. But again, in the state statutes, it seems pretty clear that a person has to commit that they're going to vote in a certain way. But of course, this is all up to interpretation by people who have a lot more brain power than I.
And a couple quick developments, Rich, before we let you go. First of all, you mentioned the Democratic Party here in Wisconsin, not taking this lightly, not looking at this as a maybe. They've got a big ad campaign. What's going on?
Yeah, they announced last week that they're going to be spending, the Democratic Party of Wisconsin is going to spend $1 million, and they've got some allies. So it's a total ad campaign worth $4 million, according to the DPW. And really, it's meant to pressure GOP lawmakers to back away from impeachment. Some lawmakers have already received a lot of communications from constituents, and we did see at least one Republican state representative say that they would not support impeachment. But the GOP has a very comfortable majority in the assembly. If some state senators were to say that they would not support impeachment, that might change things a little bit, because the margin is not as great in the state Senate. But the ad campaign from the Democratic Party is underway. And also, there was a group called the Republican Accountability Project. They announced a six-figure ad campaign today targeting Voss and Republicans for threatening impeachment. The ads are going to run on Fox News in Wisconsin. There's also going to be digital ads running in the districts of Voss and 20 other Republicans. So, yes, they're getting the word out.
And briefly, a lawsuit filed today on behalf of two Protasiewicz voters saying, trying to block any potential impeachment.
Yes. Former candidate for the Supreme Court filed this lawsuit asking the justices to issue an injunction blocking Voss and the state assembly from beginning impeachment proceedings. It's the major claims are that the assembly would be violating its constitutional authority with impeachment, because the lawsuit alleges the comments made by Protasiewicz don't come near the level required under the state constitution for impeachment. Also, the lawsuit alleges impeachment would violate constitutional rights of the two petitioners, who are Protasiewicz voters, but also the rights of others who voted for her in April.
Rich, thanks for bringing us up to date.
Thanks for having me.
That's Rich Kramer, WPR reporter. We've been talking about his reporting on talk from Republican lawmakers in Wisconsin about the idea of impeaching Justice Janet Protasiewicz, who was elected to the state Supreme Court in April, took office last month. You could join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts or questions about all of this. Coming up, a former Wisconsin state Supreme Court justice joins the show. That's up next on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're talking about threats to bring impeachment proceedings against Justice Janet Protasiewicz, the newest state Supreme Court justice. You can join in at 800-642-1234. When do you think a judge should recuse from a case? What's the bar? Does it apply here, do you think? What do you think of this idea of impeachment? Join in at 800-642-1234. Justice Jeanine Geske is a distinguished professor of law at Marquette University Law School, where she serves as director of the Andrews Center for Restorative Justice. She served on the Wisconsin Supreme Court from 1993 to 1998. Justice Geske, welcome back to Central Time.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you.
What was your reaction to hearing this floated, this idea of impeachment proceedings against Justice Protasiewicz?
It is outrageous. I am incredibly upset about the legislature or legislators threatening a justice about something that she might do in the future. And so, I'm just speechless that they would misuse that constitutional provision in that way.
Let's get into the idea of recusal at the center of this. Republicans, whether they end up impeaching or not, saying, hey, now Justice Protasiewicz in the campaign shouldn't have said these the state's redistricting maps were rigged. That shows a sign of bias in cases that are likely to come to her. What do you think of that argument?
Well, let me back up for a minute. There's some big irony here. There was a case out of Minnesota, it was referred to during the last discussion. It's the Republican Party of Minnesota versus White that went to the United States Supreme Court, and the Republicans in Minnesota were arguing that judicial candidates should be able to state their opinions on legal and political issues as long as they don't commit to a final vote. And the U.S. Supreme Court, the conservative part of the Supreme Court, said you can't constitutionally bar a candidate from doing that. They have a First Amendment right of stating their opinion on legal and political issues. So there's some irony there that it was the Republicans making that argument, and the Republican, the more conservative justices held that way. So what Justice Protasiewicz did during her campaign is exactly permitted under Minnesota versus White. So the next stage is now, of course, the Republicans are upset that they think that she's going to vote a certain way on the case. She's never committed on that. And they're threatening impeachment for something she hasn't done yet. They're not threatening to impeach her for the campaign. They're threatening to impeach her in case she decides not to recuse herself. So it's really just threatening her in advance. And finally, I think that, you know, even if it were a violation of the judicial code, which I don't think it is, for her to sit, the it doesn't mean that it fits the constitutional definition of impeachment, which requires corruption or a crime, neither of which are invoked at all in this situation. So, you know, and I am concerned what the legislators are thinking about is going ahead with the impeachment, not necessarily going to the trial, but pulling her off the cases that are going to be heard by the court this session.
Another concern that's been raised has to do with donations. In this case, the state's Democratic Party directly supported the campaign of Protasiewicz. We've seen support for various candidates from Republican and Democratic parties, influential donors on both sides of the aisle. Do you see that as grounds for recusal? And if so, when?
Well, it's interesting. That's another interesting point, because I was part of a group of retired judges that filed a petition before the court a couple years ago asking the court to adopt a rule about contributions, political contributions, and recusal. And the majority of the court at that time decided not, said absolutely not. A political contribution cannot disqualify a judge. And so we have the most liberal or conservative, depending which way you want to read it, ethical provision in the country on that issue, saying that contributions should not make a difference. On the other hand, you know, there is an argument that the Democratic Party would benefit, obviously, if the case were reversed from a previous decision. And so there's an argument there, but the problem is there's no ethical provision that covers that. And in fact, the ethical provision that the Supreme Court's adopted actually would allow her to sit on the case. We'll have to see what she's done. My understanding is she's not decided yet. She's asked for briefs from the parties, and she'll make the decision, you know, one way or another. But this threatening her to take certain action is really disturbing.
Former State Supreme Court Justice Jeanine Geske about the latest on the Supreme Court. The newest justice calls for possible impeachment if she doesn't recuse from a case she commented on during the campaign, or an issue she commented on during the campaign. Let's bring on a caller. Chris is with us in Eau Claire. Chris, hello.
Hi. So I am a voter. I voted here in Wisconsin for Justice Protasiewicz. And I have very much have interest in seeing this case taken up. In some cases here, some of these districts, it would take almost a 75% vote to remove some of these people from their districts. So I feel that this move in Wisconsin is directly an attack on me as a voter. It's an attempt to silence or intimidate my voice here as a voter here in Wisconsin.
Chris, thanks for that call. And Justice Geske, Rich was telling us about this lawsuit, making basically Chris's argument there, preemptively saying No, state legislature, this doesn't meet the grounds for impeachment, and it violates the rights of voters like Chris. What do you think of that attempt at a preemptive lawsuit?
Well, I think the first part of it, in terms of trying to restrain the legislature, I think legally that may be some problematic before they've done anything that to restrain them. The second part is really an interesting argument, but, you know, people had voted for somebody. That doesn't mean they can't be impeached down the road. The question is, are there grounds for that impeachment, which I don't think there are. You know, one of the ironies in all of this is that not only has Justice Protasiewicz offered sort of an opinion on how she sees these maps, but so has every other member of the court because they decided it a year ago. So they're all on record as to what they saw that last case to look like. So it's a little ironic that anybody's worrying about what she said when we're going to know what they've all said. And the question is, as one caller pointed out, is the map legal or not? And what are the issues on the case that's being brought up?
I want to spend a few minutes, Justice Geske, talking about changes on our Supreme Court. Now, I don't know if the 1990s when you served were, you know, a golden age of peace and harmony on the court, but it seems like things have gotten more polarized. I mean, apart from, you know, when we had an argument about whether one justice had tried to strangle another or just brushed his hands against her neck, even apart from that, it seems like things are more polarized on the court and in the campaigns. Is there something to that?
Well, I think they are, although there is often dissension on the one on our court and courts all over the country. There are, you know, there are people with very different judicial views, sometimes different political views in the past, and big egos. I mean, and I was one of them, so I'll put myself in that basket. And so it's not uncommon that there's a lot of argument, discord, or even dislike of others. But the difference now is that it's gone public, that we've had things like press conferences and people on radio talking about the inner workings of the court. And we really tried, and other courts have tried, to keep it internal, to have the disputes at the table, but not to make it public. And what that does is it undermines the court's credibility with the public, because the public is looking at this. And I get asked all the time, what's happening up there? And that's really unfortunate, because we need the support of the population for the judicial decisions. Otherwise, the courts, you know, can't play their role as that third independent branch.
There's a perception, I think, now, Justice Geske, that, yes, it's a nonpartisan race. You don't run with a D or an R next to your name on the ballot. But everybody kind of knows this is the Democratic candidate and this is the Republican candidate. I mean, is that being fair to the justices? Do you think that they are in some ways above that partisanship?
Well, I think it's really unfortunate that that's what's happened to our judicial races. You know, states like Texas, the judicial candidates have run on parties for as long as I can remember. But Wisconsin had a very proud judiciary that did not run on political party issues. And frankly, candidates tried to get people from both sides of the aisle in support. It was not infrequent that a candidate would have a Republican governor and a Democratic governor both as co-chairs. And that's changed. And now, you know, our world, our culture is so divided down partisan lines. Unfortunately, that's happened with our courts. And, and then you see the kind of money, the $50 million that were spent on this race being poured into sort of the media campaign on that theory. I think it's really unfortunate. And people get the sense that it's a legislative kind of body rather than a judicial one.
And very briefly, Justice Geske, if current justices called you up and said, hey, how can we work together better? What would be your piece of advice for them?
Well, you know, I believe that they probably need, and I'm not suggesting myself that I do this work, but they need an independent, out-of-state, somebody that doesn't know them, mediator to come and help facilitate discussions, because it appears, at least from what I've read, that they don't trust each other at all. And without trusting each other, it's very difficult to find a collaborative result on some of these issues, or at least to treat each other respectfully on these issues. And I think they probably need some outside help at this point.
Justice Geske, thanks a lot for joining us again today.
You're welcome.
That's Justice Jeanine Geske, Distinguished Professor of Law at Marquette University Law School, Director of the Andrew Center for Restorative Justice, and a former Wisconsin State Supreme Court Justice back in the 90s. Been looking at the latest news about current Justice Janet Protasiewicz and what's at stake if impeachment proceedings are brought against her, and some of the wider issues and discord facing Wisconsin State Supreme Court. Coming up tomorrow on The Morning Show with Kate Archer-Kent, students are kicking off their science classes in the new school year. What are some of the best ways to teach that subject? Kate and her guests look at science education and some ways we could maybe improve it. That's tomorrow morning at 8 here on the Ideas Network. Have you ever heard the sound of your own voice on a recording, say, and thought, do I really sound like that? Or, oh no, I can't believe I sound like that? If so, you are not alone. A survey out this summer asked people if they like the sound of their own voices. And when they asked if they like their voices when they hear them on a recording, 57% of people said, nope, don't like it. Over half of people said they would or might be interested in changing their voices. Part of the story is physics. When we're talking and hearing our own voices, we get the inside experience with vibrations in our heads amplifying the sound for us. On a recording, all that's gone. We hear it like everybody else hears it. I can relate. When I first did stuff on the radio, I really did not like hearing my own voice. Really, really. Now, I'm okay with it, and maybe that's because I got better at talking. Maybe it's because I lowered my expectations a lot. I don't know, but either way, it's working for me. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network.